It can get lonely climbing Mount McKinley, so to entertain myself, I go to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, I can play hundreds of online casino-style games for free, like online slots, bingo, slingo, and more. Plus, I get a daily login bonus. It's just too bad that up here, I don't have anyone to share my excitement with. Woohoo! Woo-hoo!
Live the Chumba life anytime, anywhere. Play for free now at ChumbaCasino.com. VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Over the past few episodes, we've profiled the focal points of our modern nationalist movement in Moscow, Idaho, its roots, its reconstruction, and its fruits. This is not a mere academic exercise, but a warning. These ideas have consequences. I had the chance to talk with Thabiti Enubile, former board member at the Gospel Coalition, about his 27 blog post swap with Doug Wilson over his 1996 booklet, Southern Slavery as It Was, and 2005 book, Black and Tan. What started with Thabiti's post on March 12, 2013, why respond publicly to Douglas Wilson's Black and Tan, convened with a post on April 2, 2013, a Black and Tan roundup. Thabiti wrote 13 blogs to Doug's 14, though many followed after, rejoinders, apologies, explanations, etc. You could say the evangelical world took notice. It seems that since the debate in the early mid-2010s and the flurry of ink spilled thereafter has confused Doug and his group of Moscovites and neo-Confederate LARPers. There's this sense that he holds no racism in his heart, nor is there anything particularly wrong with his view of Southern slavery as it was. My guess, though, if you've seen the recent direction Christian nationalist rhetoric has taken, you might question Doug and his gaggle of groupies. So we've got a special episode for you. My conversation with Thabiti Enubile about this tussle. A white man from Moscow debating the happiness of slaves brought to the United States with a black man from D.C. who's got a different story. I'll let you decide what you think of Doug's views at the conclusion of this conversation. Welcome to Episode 7, An Excursus, a conversation with Thabiti Enubile on Doug Wilson. Our conversation ranges from the exchanging of emails and blog posts between Thabiti and Doug, how the Bible talks about slavery and servitude, what black people really went through in the South, how we might have better conversations on these issues, and how the gospel redeems all. Let's talk about racism and slavery and the people who still can't quite figure it out. All right. So we got someone else coming on who has interacted with Doug online about some rather hot button topics that we're gonna get into here in just a sec. So if you can introduce yourself, the institutions that you're part of, and maybe how people might have heard or read or seen you before, and how you got introduced to Mr. Doug Wilson.
Yeah, I am Thabiti Enubile. I'm pastor of a local church in Washington, D.C. called Anacostia River Church. Also have the privilege of serving as a president of the Creek Collective. It's a church planting effort that focuses on vulnerable and neglected black and brown neighborhoods. I was formerly a member of the Council of the Gospel Coalition and first encountered Doug Wilson in that setting and in a local church that I used to be a part of. The church that I used to be a part of once carried, I think, his marriage book on the bookstall and kind of quietly removed it from the bookstall. And when I asked one of the pastors why, he kind of quietly said, he's written some things in defense of slavery. And so we've taken the book off the bookstall. And I thought, well, that's something you should be loud about, not quiet about. And it would be a few years later that Doug would begin to appear at things like John Piper's conference in Minnesota and occasionally have some things on the Gospel Coalition. That's when I became to be a bit more aware of who he was and his style of engaging publicly and some of the positions that he stands for.
Yeah, so you've known about him for quite a bit. I think that's what we're trying to prove in this series, is this has not been a fringe nor a small nor even a recent movement. This has been out for a little bit.
Yeah, like, for example, the removal of his book from that church's bookstall. I joined that church in 2000, so that might have been around 2003, 2004, somewhere in that range. So we're talking, in terms of my introduction to him, at least 20 years. And if the book's presence on a church's bookstall is any indication of influence, that he has had some kind of influence for at least the last two decades.
Yeah. Had you, before we even get to the Black and Tan book, had you heard of his slavery booklet before his Black and Tan booklet or his book?
That might have been what the reference was to with the pastor removing the book. But no, I had known him primarily through the marriage book. I had not known anything else really about him until being introduced to Black and Tan and I guess the pamphlet that Black and Tan sort of expands and his describing himself as a paleo-Confederate and the kinds of comments in Black and Tan that are just really historical revisionism. And I find morally repugnant.
Same here. Yeah, that's why this series exists, is we're gonna hold his feet over the fire for some of the stuff that he said. So how did you get into the parlay, the debate between you and Doug Wilson on Black and Tan?
Yeah, by failing to mind my business in social media. I was on Twitter one day, and I think it was Brian Laritz who had posted a tweet condemning Black and Tan for what he saw as this sort of racist content of the book. And I might have gotten tagged in that tweet or I saw that tweet and I commented, this stuff needs to be condemned in the strongest terms possible. And I didn't think much about it until, you know, a few minutes later, Doug Wilson replies to Brian and myself. I think he even tagged Eric Mason and basically all the Black guys and said some outlandish things, probably made reference to Chicago and violence in Chicago and some other things. And at that point, I thought, okay, rather than just make a dismissive statement on Twitter, let's actually engage with this. And so did a reading of Black and Tan and began to put up a series of posts in review of the book and engagement with Doug. So that led to a back and forth with Doug that probably included all total 40 blog posts or something.
I know I saw some of them. I didn't know it was 40 blog posts.
It's a lot. I feel like I wrote 15 or 20 and he wrote 15 or 20 in reply or so. So it's 30 to 40 posts easily, I think.
So this wasn't a small spat. This was a deep and a rigorous debate between you and him.
I think so. And, you know, he wanted to sort of take the blog posts and put them in book form and publish them and donate the proceeds to any organization I chose, which I declined because I thought, actually, that's just going to, in some ways, contribute to your legitimacy and the perception of your legitimacy. And I don't want to
look. I got Tabiti behind me. I'm not racist.
Yeah. So I didn't want to do that beyond the back and forth that we had already in the blog post.
Gotcha. So I know this is a little bit ago, but if you can, as far as you remember, what were some of Doug's revisionist historical assertions? And what did you, so people who are listening, if they haven't read it or seen this, what does Doug claim in this book? And what you're like, no, this is not what happened.
Yeah, it has been a little bit, but the things that still stick out in the memory is Doug describes himself as a paleo-Confederate. And you have to ask him to unpack that term a bit. Yeah. As far as I know, he's one of the few people who uses it.
Yeah, we unpack this with Russell Moore. He tells us some stuff that happened and what paleo-Confederate means in the South.
Excellent, yeah. And so I think Doug has bought into basically lost cause mythology. He is recasting the South, in his words, as the most Christian civilization in the history of the world.
Yeah.
And he is retelling the story of slavery, not really retelling, I think he's just picking up some old tropes, where slavery is essentially this happy relationship between masters and slaves. And most masters treated their slaves well, and most slaves were happy to be slaves, or if not happy to be slaves, at least happy with their material condition in slavery. And so it's a lionizing of the South and a Christianizing of the South that contradicts every shred, really, of evidence and history and what we know about life in the South, particularly for enslaved persons in the South. And so, you know, with that kind of as his premise and his statements, he's at some pains to kind of show that slavery wasn't all that bad. The other thing that he's interested to do, which I thought was interesting and odd, he's at pains to try and show why our opposition to abortion should not include violence, right? And he's having to make that argument in part because of a friend of his at one point, a ministry colleague of his at one point, took his opposition to abortion to the point of shooting abortion clinic doctors. And Doug is trying to sort of disassociate from that kind of extremism. And it resorts to these intellectual gymnastics around slavery. So therefore, the Civil War was wrong, right? So we need to be able to oppose abortion without going to violence. Well, what else was something we maybe should have opposed without resorting to violence? Ah, the Civil War and slavery. And so that only makes sense, though, if you can retell slavery in a way that washes it pretty clean and Christianizes it as a benevolent institution and Christianizes slaveholders and slave society as a benevolent, do-good kind of society that eventually would have done the right thing in abolishing slavery had we just sort of let the wheels of progress and time grind slowly in that direction, that that awareness was dawning on them already, and they would have made these moves themselves, and the Civil War was an unnecessary provocation that resulted in hundreds of thousands of lives lost that should not have been because of the North's extremism.
I was looking through your blog post earlier. You say, as I see it, the three basic aspects of the book need addressing. One, the underlying logic guiding the entire book. Two, the exegetical case for slavery as a permissible institution. And three, the historical claim that the South is a nation and the slavery of practice was comparable to the Roman practice the Apostle Paul addressed. So I want to dig into some of these things. What logic underlies the book as you recall it?
Yeah, it's what I was talking about before here, I think, just that that need to find a historical example that analogizes to abortion that helps him to be able to make the case that we shouldn't go to abortion extremism, anti-abortion extremism. And so, slavery would be the sort of counterexample or comparative example, and the Civil War would be the historical illustration of extremism that should have been avoided.
Gotcha. Okay. That helps clarify the first part. And I know the second part, which has been odd more recently, and this is, again, admittedly more on social media than anywhere else, which is not always the greatest place to be. But there has been more of an uptick on like, well, Leviticus upholds the practice of slavery. So you know what? It's not that bad for us to do right now. And Paul talks to Onesimus and Philemon. And yeah, he's all right with masters and slaves. And so, you know, if the Bible says it, I believe it. Is that where you go with, is that what you should be doing with slavery and the Bible? If you can help provide a maybe a slightly better interpretation of, yeah, man, the exegetical case, like they allowed it just for, for certain reasons and provide a better life for non-Israelites. Is that what's happening in the Bible?
Oh, no, it's not what's happening in the Bible. That's not a good way of approaching those texts. And, you know, at, on one level, I think when you hear someone talking like that, the question is, why are you making that argument? Right. So slavery, 1863, we finished the Civil War, we abolished slavery, et cetera. The issue was done for, you know, well over 160 years, 50 years. What, where is this coming from? Why are you making that case? What's really beneath that assertion? Because it's not really about how do we deal with the Bible? Because when we sort of talk about what the Bible goes on to say, right? Because we are biblical Christians. We do have a whole Bible. We do have a whole canon. Yep. We should be interpreting the Old Testament in light of the New Testament.
Yep.
And so when we come to the New Testament, we read things like this in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, or 1 Timothy, excuse me, chapter 1, verse 10, that slavery is listed among the things that is contrary to the gospel.
Yep.
Right, which in New Testament speak is the strongest condemnation that you could give to something, is to say that here's a sin, man stealing or slavery, enslavement. Here's a sin that is actually contrary to the central message of Christianity, the good news about Jesus Christ. The thing that makes you a Christian, that thing called slavery, is his opposite. Right. So why are we making an argument that this is justifiable? Or you look to Philemon. Paul is very clear there when he addresses the situation there with Onesimus, and he says, look, receive him back as a brother.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I take, and Doug agrees with, which means free him. You know, set him free. Don't bring him back as a slave, but receive him back as a brother. Paul says, receive him as if you were receiving me, right? And if there's any debt that he owes, I'll pay it, right? So if that's not clear, Paul argues in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, around verse 23, I think it is, if my memory serves, he addresses slaves in particular. He's talking in general to people, to sort of whatever state you were saved in, whatever was your condition when you were saved. Were you married? Were you single? Were you slave? He's like, don't worry about it. Stay in that condition. You belong to Christ. Rejoice in the salvation you have. But then he has this parenthetical statement that he says to the slave. He says, however, if you can get your freedom, get it.
Yeah.
Right? So far from being pro-slavery in the household codes, which is where Doug and others like to sort of camp out, where Paul gives these instructions to slaves. So clearly slaves are in the church, and he doesn't give an abolitionist argument in those texts. So he must be on some level endorsing it. Contrary to that, when Paul speaks expressly about the condition of slavery, about the practice of enslaving others, he says either get your freedom or set them free, or this is contrary to the gospel. And so I think those sort of moves back to the Old Testament, back to the law, where God is clearly separating his people from the practices of the pagan world,
yep,
and clearly setting restraints on an ungodly condition.
Yep.
Instead of going back to those texts, we got enough evidence in the New Testament about how we should be thinking about these things in light of Jesus Christ and in light of the liberative power of the gospel and the new community that it creates in the church.
Yeah. So now with this, I mean, when you were interacting in 2013 and maybe even after that, and now that we're interacting in 2024, why do you think they're making these arguments? Like, why do you think this is such a big deal for them? Like, we got to re-narrativize, or whatever the word is, slavery and the institution of slavery. Why do you think they're going back to this and like, you know what, let's retell the story again?
Their heroes are racist. Their politics are racist. Their practices at bottom are racist. And so now you've got to give intellectual justification for those things, right? The only reason you go back and defend the South is not because you're being historically honest when nobody's really even talking about it, right? The only reason you do that is, in fact, you harbor the same kind of sentiment, and you need to legitimize that sentiment publicly in order to express it freely. And so these are folks who would be at great pains to say, oh, I'm not a racist, and yet would give you the pro-slavery racist playbook in almost every conversation that you have with them. And I think that's repugnant. I think it's dishonest. And I think we just need to be clear-eyed about it.
Were you aware of some of these undercurrents or these movements even before Black and Tan came out, or before you're aware of some of the more explicit arguments for this? Were you aware of what this was shaping up in evangelicalism to be?
No. You know, I've read some historical studies. So Mark Knoll has a wonderful book in which he talks about the Civil War as a theological crisis. And it's an argument. He says it's the one theological conversation that Black and white Christians have had historically. It's an argument over slavery, which is an argument over theological anthropology, the doctrine of man. And so, you know, historical books like that, you know, I've read, you know, the sort of arguments of pro-slavery forces and the argument of abolitionist forces. In my mind, that had been sort of a historical topic for understanding the history of the nation and the church. But at that time, I didn't realize that it was fomenting into a movement that might have some quarter in mainstream evangelical and reformed Christian circles. That I think the attitude prior to 2013, et cetera, there was just no way to be respectable and be a racist publicly, right? To be known to be a racist would have been automatically disqualifying. And so I think some people, if I'm looking at it backwards now, I look at it backwards and see that very early on, people started pushing against the notion that charges of racism were wielded indiscriminately and too widely, and good people being tarnished on it, and racism, the third rail, you can't touch it. So there began this sort of quiet chipping away, and sometimes less quiet, chipping away at the moral understanding of racism and the use of the charge of racism. And to be fair, sometimes that does get bantied about too carelessly, right? But I think early on, I was mistaking a call for more precision with what was really happening, which was an undermining of the claim to racism at all. And now this thing is flowered to the point where we get people who, I think many of them being honest and with an aspiration for good, who are tragically wrong. You get a lot of people who say things like, America's not a racist country, doesn't have a racist history, there's no real racism except anti-white racism. And so you get this, you get this great Darvo kind of thing, right? You just get this great switching of victim and offender and the reversal of charges and all these kinds of things. And so that, I think, is what this thing has sort of led to in terms of its groundswell.
Yeah, even to be completely off topic of this with Doug Wilson, but still on topic with racism and slavery. I was reading Isabel Wilkerson's Cast, which is like, holy moly. I'd known some of this stuff, but I'd not known like even the Nazis in Germany, like, whoa, America, like you went too far.
That's right. So it boggles the mind, right, to hear people say, no, America's not racist. It's like, yo, the Nazis was like, let's do that, but not that far, right?
Those guys are crazy.
That's exactly right. And the folks in South Africa with apartheid, it's like, okay, let's do that USA thing. It's like this, I think it's a willful ignorance. I think it's a willful refusal to admit the truth. And I think the reason that that's there is the psychological protection, self-protection mechanism. People don't want to conclude that they are this bad thing, right? Or that they harbor these bad ideas. And often what I would run into, going back to the mid-2000s, often what I would run into is these folks defending their parents and their grandparents, right? So I had this, you know, back and forth with Phil Johnson, Grace Community Church, MacArthur, those guys. He came out of blog in retirement to attack me, right?
This guy, that means,
I was retired, but this guy is a threat to the gospel, his mission drift, and all this kind of stuff. And so from time to time, take shots, take arrows from Phil and engage Phil. And I remember it was like a thunderbolt. I remember in one of our back and forths where I was talking about my son and police violence and my concern about the sort of rise in police violence that we were seeing via body cams and all phone and all that good stuff. His retort basically included a couple of paragraphs or a paragraph where he talked about his sainted grandmother who lived through the certain period, who didn't have a racist bone in her body and was just a lovely Christian woman and on and on and on. I was like, how'd your grandmother get into this? Right. And then I just started thinking about email correspondence and other things, how often they return to, I love my meemaw, I love my pawpaw, and I don't want to call them racist. I don't want to consider their generation racist. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of, it is white fragility. There's this kind of white defensiveness. There's this
almost sort of, like, if I call my grandma racist, I kind of have to call myself racist.
Or I have to admit the poison fruit of some things that I've gotten, or I have to sort of renounce some things.
Which is so odd. If we have a robust doctrine of sin, it's like, well, how would that not be the case? If you're a sinner by nature,
that's right.
Wouldn't that also kind of input, like, it shouldn't be that difficult to make the leap to like, oh, I'm probably also got some racism in me too.
That's exactly right. So one of the posts I wrote in that period was on this notion of white impeccability, right? It's just like, just no sin must not be called this thing. Must maintain impeccability because then therefore there are all these sort of consequences, these sort of follow-on realities that I don't want to admit. And it is a repudiation of a robust doctrine of sin. There's no other way to characterize it.
Yeah. Something you said too, and this is in the middle of one of your blog posts from March 13th, 2013, under number 4. It says, Wilson calls for the denouncement of racism, but he does not see a biblical mandate for denouncing slavery as such. So if you can also dive into, you can say, or I guess you can convince yourself that you're not a racist, but like say slavery wasn't bad. How does that work?
I don't know how it works in real life. It doesn't work in real life. I don't know how it quite works in Doug's mind, but It needs to be said that except for the most virulent forms of racist and white supremacists, almost all racists deny being racist, right? Again, because at least for a good portion of recent history, everyone looked at racism as this repugnant thing, mm-hmm. right, that needed to be avoided. So most racists would deny, I'm not a racist, I just love my people kind of thing, right? And so Doug, I think, is at pains to say in the book, and does say several times in the book, I'm not a racist, I'm not a white supremacist, so on and so forth. But I'm going to defend this institution,
yeah.
which itself is predicated upon notions of race and racial inferiority and racial supremacy. And so I don't think you can have it both ways. I don't think you can say I'm not a racist while defending the most racist institution in the history of this country. You can't say I'm not a racist while sort of winking at notions of white supremacy and racial superiority, which are part of the justification for slavery and the enslavement of people. And you mentioned Bell Wilkinson a moment ago. Mm-hmm. And it really is at the genesis of this caste system,
yeah.
this racial caste system that defines the country and affects the country even up to this day.
Yeah, yeah. If I can go sort of philosophical too, if people read Charles Taylor, his Modern Social Imaginaries, it's this. These are the waters we have so swam in. And so when somebody points it out to you, you're like, well, I've never seen this before. It's, to be honest, I mean, I'm white, so it's probably because you're white and you've never had to deal with some of this stuff. Nor have I ever thought, like, if I had kids with my wife, that I would have to talk to him or her about police violence, just because, like, it's not something that was ever taught to me as a kid. But anybody else outside of me who's not white or black or brown or whatever it may be, that is a part of your life, whether you want it to be or not, because that's the society we live in. But it's if you're swimming in these waters, it could be hard to see what you're swimming in when that's all you swim in. What I also want to touch on, too, is what Wilson says, and we've touched on this, but it is one of their like linchpins. And I've heard this more recently, and you've already broached this topic, that slavery in the U.S., they say, well, we provided them a better life in the U.S. than they had in sub-Saharan Africa or on one of the coasts or wherever it is. And they'll say, well, we didn't steal them, we bought them. I was like, I don't see any material difference in any of this stuff. Can you speak to, do you think Africans were happier in Africa, or were they happier being slaves in America?
Well, I can tell you this without doubt. In the history of slavery, nobody's ever been happy being a slave.
No.
There's no people group that's like, oh, snap, you know what we would really like? We would really like for the rest of our lives and for generations to be the perpetual servants, eaten and whipped and sold and our families torn apart to serve other people, right? So just on the face of it, it's ridiculous, right? But then to go you further, a step further, it's like, even if we say folks were happier, that's false. And we know it's false because we do have collections of slave testimony. We do have people obviously running away from the South at risk of their life, at risk of maiming and being tortured. I mean, it's just, again, if we're at all historical about it, we know it's false. But just to say that life was better in the slave South, the slave North, let's say life is better on the other side of the transatlantic slave trade than it would have been in sub-Saharan Africa, it still doesn't justify the man stealing. The ends don't justify the means.
But right? They would tell you, Tabidi, that they didn't steal them, they bought them. So that makes it good.
I mean, stop. Just stop. I would love to be sort of intellectual in my response to that, but it's just like, stop it, man. Come on, bro. So if somebody else stole your child, I didn't steal him. I didn't come to your house while everybody was asleep and climb through their window and ferret them out the window and take them across to some other place and put them on an auction block. I didn't do that. But gee, they were offered at a great bargain. So, you know, so I bought them. And I really had this need for child labor. So I bought them. And this really gets at the real root of slavery. And I think Jamar Tisby does a great job of bringing this out in his book, The Color of Compromise. It's really at the bottom greed, right? It's really at the bottom greed. And that greed gets justified and reified by sort of racial theory and racism and things of that sort. But, you know, it doesn't justify it. The ends don't justify the means, because I saw and determined that there might be some good outcome in the Christianization, quote unquote, of the slave, in the civilization, quote unquote.
Yeah, at least we brought them the gospel.
That's right. You know, I brought the evangelization of the slave.
They had a shitty life. At least they believe in Jesus Christ now.
Yeah. What in the world? What in the world? No, that doesn't justify what you did, what the country participated in by any means. And so, again, it's and the arrogance of assuming that I should be the one who decides, right? If I'm representing the slaveholder society, that I should be the one who decides that this is good or right or better for the person enslaved. And that's a level of hubris that itself, again, is another kind of sin that's just needs to be condemned.
Yeah. So summarizing and concluding, when you were interacting with Doug, and I would assume to varying degrees, this is how more modern interactions would go with these kinds of movements too. Some more virulent forms and some maybe more veiled forms. But this is general, I think. If Doug were to say, like, you know what, TBD, you're right. What do you think his fear is of saying that? Like, what's the outcome if Doug says, like, shoot, I'm wrong on this stuff? As far as you can tell, or based off his books, what does he lose? What does he gain? Like, what's the outcome if Doug says, like, slavery was bad and I messed up?
Well, from his perspective, as far as I can tell, he said essentially two things. Number one, if he's wrong about this, then he doesn't have a principled reason not to become an abortion extremist or, you know, a violent person on any sort of moral issue that he might be opposed to. So that's something that he has said,
yeah,
right?
Okay.
That would be number one. Number two, if he's wrong about this, and if that means he has to sort of change how he argues about these issues, then he feels like he is also conceding the authority of the scripture, because says that we have these angular texts in the scripture where these things, at least for a period, seem to be commended or at least allowed and regulated. And so if we don't defend the biblical text on slavery, then we're basically throwing the Bible away along with all the folks who oppose it and would do something like point to slavery as reason for not trusting the Bible. So those are two things I think that Doug has argued at different times as to why he takes the position that he takes. But I do think there's another thing that might be a disincentive to saying, okay, Thabiti, you're right, and I was wrong on slavery, and now I need to write in the opposite direction. Well, there's a whole community now that has allied itself with Doug and sees Doug as a kind of standard bearer who believes these things. And he would pay a high cost to that community if he were to change his position and say, I no longer believe this. This is a community that's quite skilled and quite zealous at getting rid of folks who don't toe the line, who change the position, who represent a threat to their way of thinking. And so I think Doug would be a person then without a community and would be a person without certain kinds of influence and resources and control of institutions, et cetera. And I think this part is speculative. I think that might be a part of why he would not be someone who would say, yeah, I was wrong on this. The last thing I want to say, and maybe I shouldn't say this, maybe this really belongs to the Lord, but this is, the Lord forgive me, this would be my perspective, how I size him up. I think the other disincentive is pride. I just think there's an immense amount of pride, the kind of pride that never admits wrong, that seems never to sort of rethink a position or to concede ground, the kind of pride that even where it does sort of hint at, oh, I think differently, or this might be, it switches real quickly the subject and darts over to something else and simply reloads its verbal shotgun to fire at something else and to occupy a different ground. So it strikes me as a proud position to take in many respects. And the Lord forgive me if I'm wrong, if I'm judging unrighteously, but that'd be the other thing that I would speculate about.
Yeah. What you just said about him losing his community, I mean, I knew that theoretically, but that's a good point. I mean, he's built up this community, this following, this groupie, institutions and publishing house. Yeah, if he goes against some of this stuff, then you're right. He's locked out of his own posse. I hadn't quite thought about it like that, and I think there's some truth to that. Mm-hmm. So
this is the way every kind of fundamentalism works.
True. So last, I asked these two questions for anybody who's coming on this series. If you can speak to those white, black, brown, whatever, who might be interested in joining one of these movements and see the quote unquote principled stance that Doug takes on certain cultural issues. And he's fighting the good fight. He's fighting the liberals. He's fighting the woke. He's fighting the progressives. Can you talk to those who might be interested in joining one of these movements? Like what that really means that they're joining?
Yeah. As a pastor, I'm always concerned about the sheep and the sheep following people or movements that lead not to green pasture, but lead to barren wastelands. And this would be such a movement.
Yeah.
This is a movement that would trade in Christian language, Christian symbol, Christian text, and yet exchange the original meaning of those languages, symbols, and texts and ways of being with really an imposter religion. It is a cult. It is cultic. It is cult of personality at the very least. Mm-hmm. It will be cultic in its control of how people think. I mean, anytime you have a movement or a group that does not permit difference without swift and strong sort of shutting down of thinking, then you're tending toward cultic controlling kinds of groups and organizations. And I would be deeply grieved at anyone being taken hostage by cultic control in that way. And I would say to that person, and you're going to pay a steep cost, a really painful cost for being involved for any length of time in a movement like this. You're going to feel that cost in your own individual soul and the constriction of your liberty. It will feel initially like discipleship, like you're learning and you're being shaped into something that on the face of it is godly and zealous for God, but you're actually going to be shaped into the husk of godliness. You're going to be shaped into a false way of thinking about womanhood, of thinking about manhood, of thinking about marriaging, of thinking about parenting. You're going to be shaped into a false way of engaging publicly on behalf of the faith. And in fact, you're going to be bringing great damage to the cause of Christ, along with damage to your own soul and your own life. And the moment that you begin to feel these things, flee, run, go someplace else. You can have all the things that you long for in a movement like this. You can have a vision for strong manhood. You can have a vision for godly womanhood. You can have a vision for strong family and community. You can have a vision for zealous Christian witness without compromise. You can have all those things without being in a cult. There are perfectly orthodox, sound, joyful, strong Christians who contend for biblical understandings of these things without careening off the cliff of cultish control and cultish society and groups. So I would just implore you to think about these things, to draw back from these things, to know that moving into sort of Christian enclaves separated from the rest of society is in fact, you know, just sort of evidence of cultic behavior, right? And cultic control. We're meant to be salt and light in the world. And that doesn't happen by a withdrawal into sort of echo chambers and a withdrawal under the stronger control of strong men, even religious strong men. That happens as the Lord scatters us into the world to be salt and light and to represent him. And so I just, my heart breaks. I wish I had the perfect words, but I just want to say, you can have a vibrant, thriving Christian life, as the Christian world has done for centuries, without going over into cultic aberrations of the Christian faith.
Yeah. Yeah. Now the second group, you've already talked about this quite a bit. We've talked about this with Doug. for those who are already enmeshed in one of these communities and they're like, you know, been listening to this series, I've already had maybe a little bit of doubts creeping up and I don't know what to do. If I leave, like you said, I lose my community, I lose my friends, I lose my relationships, my pastor, possibly my husband, my wife, because I can't sign on to this anymore. What pastoral counsel would you give them?
Remember the call of Jesus in discipleship. He tells us very plain in the scriptures that if we would follow him, we're going to have to leave mother and father, sister and brothers, and communities. That's part of the cost of following him. And if you judge that Christ isn't there, but Christ is moving elsewhere, you need to go join Jesus. Now, he also gives this promise that nobody has left mother and brother, father and sister, et cetera, without him giving back to them 30, 60, 100 times in this life and in the life to come, eternal life. And so your sacrifice to follow Jesus faithfully will be painful, but it will be rewarded. The Lord sets the lonely in families. He has a family for you in a perfectly orthodox and healthy gospel church where you can know freedom and joy and serve the Lord with a good conscience in a community that has a good conscience. He has that for you. And so it'll be an act of faith to follow him into that and to trust him to provide that. And it'll be an act of faith to sort of see the pain that comes from breaking away from loved ones and community, but to see through the pain, as Jesus did, to the joy that's before you. And so this may be your cross to bear, but the Lord will reward you for it. So seek healthy counsel, seek a healthy community, get out of the abusive situation, and then figure out the rest of life, right? And so it's not unlike someone who's suffering physical abuse. The first responsible thing that we would want to do as pastors is make sure they're safe and separated from the person and the environment that led to the physical abuse. We need to do the same thing with spiritual abuse too, so that we can get some space to get a clear mind, to think about things well, and to see as Christ would have us see, and then begin to sort of make plans for how to move forward toward healing and health.
Yeah, that's a good word. Now, any final thoughts that you want to leave people with? Anything I either didn't cover or that's particularly on your heart? Anything you'd like to leave anybody who's listening with?
I think what I would say is Jesus is real, that he is worth following, that his call to love is really quite radical and profound. It's love that he appeals to in Philemon when it comes to addressing all the sort of dysfunction around enslavement and things of that sort. It's love that's appealed to when the Bible talks about how we're to treat one another and the diversity of the Lord's church. And so I would want to call people to commit themselves to a truly biblical notion of following Jesus in love. This is how they will know that we are his disciples, by our love for one another. And that love will be so radical as to love its enemies. And if you find that the community you're in is really fundamentally not loving except to people like itself, you really should find another community that's marked by love, where you can flourish in love, and where the real nature of Christ and the gospel are revealed in that love. We're not in a world that has too much love.
No, you know? Not at all.
And so if we could be called to that and committed to that, I think then we'll see the differences that we're hoping to see in our own lives and in our own families and communities and in other communities and other families and in our churches and other churches as well.
First, I want to thank Thabiti for his time, his pastoral sensitivity, his scholarship, and his directness. It was refreshing to have a conversation on difficult topics, but with the aroma of the gospel and the grace of Christ abounding. Second, are we attempting to trudge up old issues from the past, long forgotten? Are we resurrecting a conversation of a bygone era that's already been signed, sealed, and delivered? Or are we unfairly treating a pastor who's only interpreting these issues a little differently than we are? Yes and no. For many Americans, these issues are not part of the regular conversation, myself included. This isn't because they aren't important, we're just not faced with them. Too often, it's the consequences the pigment of our skin poses in modern-day society. For the lighter-skinned, we haven't needed to deal with this personally. It costs us nothing. For those darker in skin, it's the stories they go to bed with, the stories they grew up hearing, the plight their fathers and mothers, sisters and brothers, grandmas, grandpas, aunts, uncles faced on a daily basis. So no, I'm not bringing up an old issue, nor resurrecting a conversation of a bygone era, that which we no longer deal with. The paints I'm coloring Doug Wilson with is that which he has chosen to be painted with. These political, cultural, and theological ideas have real consequences. Whether that was the real-time subjugation and forced servitude of a people group deemed of a lower value and an inferior caste to another, or the fond memories of the same time period and the groups responsible for it. No theologian, politician, or thought leader is perfect. All have clay feet. There is but one, Jesus Christ. The goal, then, isn't to cancel anyone, but to deal with them honestly. You can't say they were people of their time, because that assumes the time was monolithic and entirely made up of the like-minded, which simply isn't true. We Christians have an ultimate standard, the Word of God written. All people of whatever skin color, socioeconomic background, culture, ethnicity, tradition, whatever. Everyone deserves the dignity given by God Almighty. One day, every tribe, tongue, people, and nation will bow at the feet of the throne, worshiping the Lord who redeemed them. They will no longer see the barriers between peoples we have too often been taught. Nor will anyone assume one color is below or above another, nor someone from another country to be too culturally different to assimilate. There will be a day we no longer have to lament the evils of Southern slavery, of slavery of any area, or of any peoples. A day, eternity, wherein we will rejoice with the Savior, with people we have never met, born before us and after us. But we lament these evils now. It's good and right to do it. We weep with those who weep, and we rejoice with those who rejoice. Let us then reflect the heavenly reality now, engage in these conversations with our brothers and sisters who've been engaging for so many years before, and praise the one who has brought us together. Sons of Patriarchy is brought to you by the administrators of Examining Doug Wilson in Moscow in partnership with Peter Bell. It's written, produced, and edited by Peter Bell. Original music, sound design, and mixing by Aaron Feeney. This series wouldn't be possible without the dozens of abuse survivors whose bravery and vulnerability make it what it is. Every episode was sent to them before being published, and their feedback, edits, encouragement, and eventual approval make this what it is. May your voices be heard far and wide. Thank you.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Every day when you log into ChumbaCasino.com, the ultimate online social casino, you get a free daily bonus. Imagine if you got daily bonuses in other parts of your life.
I chose French fries over loaded French fries.
I asked Stuart from accounting about his weekend, even though I don't care.
I updated my operating system without having to call tech support.
Collect your free daily bonus at ChumbaCasino.com now. And live the Chumba life. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.